Of this year, I do have a sponsor that I've had since my third day of being in the rooms. I'm currently working the steps with him and doing great. I picked up my first drink when I was 11 years old. My dad, being a chronic drinker, there was always booze around the house. One day I happened to be out with my mom shopping, and when we got back home, he was supposed to be taking care of my six other siblings, and we realized that he was nowhere to be seen as soon as we walked into the apartment, and we thought he was playing a game with the kids, and went looking for him throughout. We had a pretty big apartment at the time, seven rooms, big family, there were seven children, and so we thought he was playing a game, and we were looking through all the rooms for him, and I happened to walk into the last room that had not been looked into yet and found him hanging in a closet. That's where his disease took him eventually. At the time, you know, growing up, I grew up in New York City. I don't remember ever hearing about AA. I didn't find out about AA till I was in Florida. But anyway, that year, shortly after that, there was always a lot of male figures in the house. My mother's brothers or my older brother, who lived outside of the home, and he would come over to visit. I had an uncle that actually stayed with us for a while as well. And so there was always, alcoholism runs in my family. There was always alcohol in the fridge while they were around. And one day while my uncle was cooking, I snuck into the kitchen and grabbed a beer out of the refrigerator and took it into my bedroom and just hung out and drank it. And I remember the effect that it had on me. It gave me that numbing feeling. And I remember thinking something to the effect of, wow, this is pretty cool. You know, I like the way this feels. And shortly after that, I realized right after that what a great way to escape the reality that was going on around me. And so as time went on, it progressed very quickly. I loved having my uncles and my brother around because it was an unlimited supply of booze for me. And nobody ever noticed. I guess they were too busy getting into their own thing. And I would go into my bedroom to drink it, so I don't think they ever noticed. And if anybody did, I guess they really didn't want to bother me or didn't care. You know, it was not a big deal. I remember it did progress very quickly for me. Through my mid-teens, I started drinking even more heavily. It finally got to the point where the only way I would drink was if I could drink enough to be able to black out. So that was pretty much most of the time. I did start to, because of the home situation around my early teens, spending a lot of time on the streets in New York. And that was part of what I did. You know, I got so comfortable with that. I eventually wound up, we all got split up, the siblings, and we wound up in different homes because my mom could not take care of us. And so that really sent me into a big spiral where I started to drink even more because we did have a lot of freedom in the place where I was at. I was able to go to high school during the day, come back in the evenings and, you know, have dinner and everything else at the boys' home. But for me, it just became a thing where I would leave like I was going to school and just spend the day on the streets with my beer, and at the time I used to smoke a lot of weed, so smoking a lot of the weed, and that was my life. It was the streets, you know. I just didn't feel comfortable anywhere else. I didn't want to go home because I didn't want to have to deal with that situation. And eventually the time came where I had to, on my 18th birthday, decide whether or not I was going to continue at the boys' home and go to college, or just exit and do my thing at that point. And I decided that I didn't want to go to college. I was so used to just hanging out, drinking and you know, doing my drugs that was not a way for me to go. And so I said, no, I guess I'll just leave. And realized that shit, now it's like really, I either have to go back home for a short period of time and stay there till I could find something else to do. And unfortunately, that is what I had to do. It worked out okay, but I immediately joined the military after that. And like many of the other things that I tried while I was in my drinking career, I kind of messed that up because I just wanted to go off base most of the time, get drunk, and a lot of times I wouldn't even show up for formation in the morning. Luckily, I wound up with a honorable discharge because of the process that I had to go through to make my exit. Yeah, so my drinking just progressed over the years. I drank very heavily. I wound up getting over the years, I wound up with 3 DUIs. Luckily, they were pretty far spread apart where I didn't have to suffer the really hard consequences that come with that. Yeah, there was a lot of money that came out of my pocket, the probation and all the horrible stuff that I had to deal with, but you know, I did put myself there. More recently, I had tried AA several years ago, about 15 years ago. I tried to do it in such a way that I was not willing to do all the work that was required or suggested. And so I started drinking right away. I mean, I was going to the meetings and all, but I was having my booze on the side. And the way I looked at it back then, I thought, as long as I don't get super drunk to where I have to go to a meeting and have them smell it on me or notice it, then I'm okay. And so I was doing the wrong things from the get-go back then. Fortunately, this time around, things got really hard. I came close to death several times. I got into this thing where I would get so drunk that I would fall and hit my head, and that was happening on a pretty regular basis. Several times I blacked out when that happened, and I eventually came to, and everything was happy-go-lucky, and I kept doing whatever I was doing. One of the last times that it happened, though, I did. Luckily, my neighbor found me in time, but I had been partying with a neighbor outside. Got into my apartment, shut the door, but luckily something in me didn't let me lock the door, which I always do. And I was super drunk, fell on my tiled floor, busted my head open, and when he came to the door, he found me passed out on the floor with a puddle of blood around my head. Called the ambulance. They actually had to intubate me because I couldn't breathe on my own, so I came pretty close to death that time as well. I remember coming to in the hospital and having my hands tied to the rails on the bed and totally freaking out because it was the first time that I had ever been in a situation where I was tied down like that and had a tube down my throat. And obviously, they did it so I wouldn't pull the tube out when I came to, but yeah, so, you know, through all of that, I've had triple bypass open heart surgery, and I'm sure that the alcoholism had something to do with that, as well as some brain surgery back in 2000, and still, through all of that, I still wanted to continue to drink, but this time around, I came in, I was very willing. From the get-go, I got very involved with the service work where I started out, which was over at OSG, and you know, just doing the coffee and all that, and I'm still working on my steps. So with steps 1, 2, and 3, you know, I obviously made a decision to, I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol because that was something I'd never done over the years, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. So I grew up as a Catholic and experimented with different religions over the years. And although I was doing all that, I was very involved with the last church I was in. I held a higher priesthood, did all the missionary work. None of that could ever do anything for me. I still continue. A lot of times I would go to church and I couldn't wait to leave to get home and have a couple of brews. So that never really worked for me then. And then I made a decision this time around, you know, to turn my will over to a God of my understanding, the God that I always believed in as a kid, you know, who wasn't judging me for every little thing I did, because that was where I had the problem when it came to religion. You know, it was a punishing God that I just didn't see him that way. But anyway, he accepted me fully for who I was. Then on step 4 and 5, I made a, you know, the searching and fearless moral inventory, which was not very pleasant. I've been drinking for 52 years, so there's a lot of stuff in my background that I didn't want to have to discuss with someone. But, you know, like I said earlier, I was very willing to do whatever it took, and I got it done. Also, with step 6 and 7, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. And, sorry guys, I'm trying to turn this off. Not going to happen. Might help if I had my glasses on. I was entirely ready to have God remove all these, the defects that I bring in. That's a process. You know, I'm still, you know, obviously that's going to take some time, especially with some of the older stuff. But, you know, I've noticed something I shared recently with my sponsor is that the more willing and receptive that I am to wanting to change, I've noticed that with a couple of things that I had to let go of, I haven't had to focus on them or struggle with them. It just happened. And for that, I'm very grateful, you know, that I don't have to fight anything. Then on step 8, I made a list of all the persons that I had harmed and was willing to make amends to them all. And in 9, I started that process actually recently. And what an amazing thing. One thing I shared was my parents were the first ones on my resentment list. And doing that step, I was able to turn it around and say, well, you know, now it's my turn to look at the situation and see what my role in this was. I had major resentments towards my dad because of his suicide over the years, and my mom because of some of the things that happened, felt kind of let down. But when I went ahead and did that step, it helped me to see my role in it. It was interesting because even though I did the 4th and 5th, it felt like I still hung on to some of that stuff that had to do with my parents. And when I did that, I actually did it. They both passed. You know, they're up. I like to call it heaven. And so I wrote a letter to each one of them, and I thought that wasn't going to be so bad because it was a letter, but it was very emotional, and there was some healing that came along with it. And I feel more at peace now that I was able to get that done. It was like it happened very quickly. I'm very grateful for the program. I've been, like I said, here since January the 23rd, so that's a little over 4.5 months. I'm doing great, I'm very happy. I have a great sponsor that's always there, you know, when I need him, and he helps me out a great deal. The people in the groups that I attend meetings at, you know, that you guys are all the ones that have helped me to get here. Listening to your stories and your shares, and I think that's I'm just going to keep doing what it takes and hope, you know, keep at it and try to continue to progress and grow in the spirit. And I thank you all for letting me share, and you all have a great night. Thank you.
Raphael, for sharing for us. Our group has asked Blair to be our main speaker tonight. All right. Hey, everybody. My name is Blair. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's February 6, 2007, and I have a sponsor and a sponsor others. They're actually all here tonight. And my home group is the Monday Night New Tampa Men's Group. And I was talking to my buddy on the way over here, and he said, if you're going to get up there and talk about getting wasted and picking shrooms, make sure you wear a tie so you look good talking about it. Plus I didn't want Raphael to outdress me. He said he was wearing a tie. So I want to give a shout out to Lloyd on Zoom. I know you're on there. Wish you were here. But this was my home group when I first got sober. So this is where I got sober at. I think this was my home group for like my first 8 years of sobriety. So this is like home for me coming back here. A lot of stuff happened here, and I'm very grateful for this group. A lot of guys that I got sober with that helped me get sober are still here, you know, which is awesome. And some of them are not, you know, some of them are still out there, and some of them have passed away. You know, that's actually happened a lot since I've been here in 15 years. A lot of friends stopped coming around, and got back into that old life and ended up passing away. So, you know, that's just the reality of this. That's what's out there waiting for me. That you know, the way that I drink, that's a real good possibility that something like that will happen to me. But so I'm just going to start my story like I always do, just from the beginning. I was born in New Jersey, and my parents split up when I was pretty young. And I don't talk too much about my childhood, but I'll just kind of touch on it because there's a couple things in there that are pertinent to my story. But my parents split up when I was like two. My dad cheated on my mom. He left. That was like my first resentment, you know, that my dad cheated on my mom. He left us for another woman, and I didn't know that's what it was at the time, but I was resentful at my dad, and I would hear things from my mom's side of the family about my dad that I probably shouldn't have heard that kind of fed that resentment. And like as far back as I could remember, like as a kid, I could be in a room full of people and just feel like I was by myself. You know, I remember that feeling like in kindergarten. And then also just like that selfishness and self-centeredness to the core as a kid. Like I remember being in the cafeteria in like kindergarten or first grade and like eating my lunch and feeling like everybody was watching me. like everyone's watching me eat my sandwich. And like that selfishness and self-centeredness, like to the core, because like not only was I always thinking about me, but I thought everyone else was thinking about me too. You know, which is crazy. But so that made for like that made me like a pretty anxious kid. You know, I was pretty anxious. I always felt like with my peers, if you really got to know me, you probably wouldn't like me. You know, I had feelings of just insecurity, feelings like I didn't quite measure up. But on the outside, like everything was normal. I had a good childhood. Like we moved down here when I was seven. My mom remarried. I always had friends over after school, played sports. We're always outside doing stuff, shooting our BB guns in the woods, playing basketball, getting into trouble too, you know, trying to see what we can get away with, like doing things like burning forests down and stuff like that. Yeah, I was a real pyro when I was a kid. And like things like that always seem like a good idea until you get caught, right? Like once you get caught, you're like, I don't know what I was thinking. But you get away with it, you're like, that was awesome. But like I said, just kind of growing up, I didn't want to let people in because, I felt like if you really got to know me, you probably wouldn't like me. And, you know, by kindergarten, first grade, I probably could have used a few drinks. Like I didn't start drinking until I was 15, but I look back at my childhood, I'm like, I could have used it at 7 years old, you know? And just anxious, just white, like it's just strung up tight. And so I'll fast forward, I'll get right to my first time getting drunk. I remember it like it was yesterday because it was life-changing. Like the trajectory of my life changed after that first time I got drunk. I got off of school one day. I was a sophomore in high school. I got off of school. I hopped on my moped. I went over to my cousin's house, and we planned it ahead of time. We started raiding his dad's liquor cabinet. We started pouring a little bit out of each bottle into a cup, and that way, you know, he wouldn't notice that any was missing. So pour a little bit of this, a little bit of that, until I filled this cup up. And I remember stirring it up with my finger, and I remember I started drinking it, and like I was like gagging, you know, like it burnt all the way down. I felt like I was gonna throw up every time I sipped it, and I remember saying to my cousin, I was like, man, why do people drink this shit? And he said, just keep drinking, you'll understand. So I did. We grabbed some Hawaiian punch. I started chasing it with the Hawaiian punch. And, you know, like, I'm not really enjoying this process. I'm, like, sipping the booze, and then I'm chugging the Hawaiian punch and going back and forth. But, like, maybe 10 or 15 minutes later, I understood why people drank that shit. Like it wasn't for the taste. It was for how it made me feel. The effect that it brought on me was amazing. I loved it. I remember standing in my cousin's cousin's living room. And all those fears I had as a kid, those insecurities, feeling like I didn't measure up, that it was gone. Like, it wasn't even there. It wasn't an issue anymore. And I remember thinking, that first time getting drunk, I remember thinking, if I could feel like this all the time, my life would be great. Like, I remember having that thought the first time I got drunk. And I also remember us jumping back on the moped. And I was on the back, and I remember I got thrown off of it. My cousin was doing donuts. I got right back on, you know. I didn't feel it, obviously. But I remember, I don't know how long into this it was, maybe 30 minutes, maybe an hour, but I remember thinking, I need to get more. Like, I remember thinking, and I was telling my cousin, I was like, we got to get more, because I was like, this is going to wear off eventually, and I got to keep this in my system. Like, this is awesome. So I remember that too. I remember we like went over to a friend's house. We tried to find more, and anyway, no big consequences. The other thing I do remember of that time was I was telling him to drive me to different girls' houses from school, because I was like, I had the courage to talk to these girls that I was like, I better take advantage of this, you know? So like girls that I couldn't even like really make eye contact with in school, you know, like I was like terrified to talk to them, but now I'm going up to their house, like chit chatting with their dad, you know, like, where's Lindsay at, you know? So like I said, like alcohol just, man, it felt like it made me the person I always wanted to be. So I fell in love with it. And I didn't drink every day at that time because I just couldn't get alcohol every day. But I started, what I would do is I would steal it from my grandfather, his liquor cabinet, or I would steal it from a friend's parents' liquor cabinet, or we would go up to the store and have somebody buy it for us. And I remember like making sure I had enough to get drunk, like stashed up, because like that's just how I drank from the beginning. I never saw any point in getting having two or three and then stopping. Like, that just, it didn't make sense to me. Like, ever since that first experience of getting drunk, like, that was the mark I was shooting for, you know? Like, I didn't want a light buzz. Like, I wanted to get drunk. And so that's what I would do. And I started drinking by myself early on. I remember it'd be like a Tuesday afternoon after school, I'd be getting drunk by myself. And I remember one of my friends saying, he's like, dude, why are you drinking by yourself on a Tuesday afternoon? That's kind of like alcoholic stuff. And I remember saying, why are you not drinking by yourself on a Tuesday afternoon? Like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, what does it matter what time of week it is? Like, this stuff makes me feel great. I'm going to drink it whenever I can. So, I loved the effect. And like, so anything that was important to me prior to that got put in the back seat. Like, basketball, I loved basketball. I loved getting out in the woods. Like, I was like, I loved outdoors. I loved like just hanging with my friends and doing like riding bikes. And like I said, getting in a little bit of trouble here and there, but all that stuff was not important anymore. Like, it was when can I get drunk next? Like, that was like, that became my priority now. And some consequences early on, like when you drink like that, you're gonna get consequences, you know? So like the first night that I took my first car out, I totaled it in a blackout. I think this story is important to talk about, because like this is where like the phenomenon of craving took place early on in my drinking. So like this night, this was my first night taking my car out. So like this night, I remember saying, I'm only going to have a few drinks because I'm driving, and I had a car full of people. Up until this point, I really had no reason to stop at a few. So, but I was trying to like common sense, right? Like, don't drink and drive. I'll have a few. So we get to this keg party. I go straight for the alcohol. I start drinking. And by the time I got that third or fourth drink in me, I was like, yeah, no, I'm going to keep drinking. You know, like I just remember thinking like, somebody will get me home. Like, somebody, or my house is right up the road. I will make it home. And I just kept drinking. And like I said, long story short, I blacked out. I totaled my car. Luckily didn't get hurt. Luckily didn't hurt anyone else. But just consequences like that started to come. And it was worth it though. Like, at the time, like the payoff of of booze compared to like consequences like that, it was still worth it. Like it, like stuff like that was not, was like it, it wasn't like stuff like that would happen and I'd be like, oh, maybe I should quit drinking. Like that wasn't even a thought that crossed my mind. I remember thinking, I'll never drink and drive again, but nowhere in my mind was it, I'm not gonna drink again. And I can't even count on, I can't even count how many times I've drank and drove since then. Like once I start drinking, I just somehow, for some reason, end up behind the wheel. Like it's just fun driving a stick shift when you're wasted. I don't know. So I'll fast forward a little bit. My mom sent me up to New Jersey, thought my dad could straighten me out. He was an FBI agent at the time. She filled him in on like the stuff I was doing at that time. At this point in my drinking, I'm like doing some hard drugs too. And I just became open to whatever was available, you know, at school. Drinking was a constant. I dabbled with different types of drugs at different points in my drinking, but drinking was always the constant. And nothing else really ever did it for me like alcohol. Like there, like getting high was fun, you know, like it was better than sober, that's for sure. And it was fun. And I found I could get in, I wouldn't get in as much trouble if I went to work high compared to when I went to work drunk, because I think I fell off a ladder once going to work drunk and it was like reeking out of my pores. So there were, you know, so I would get high as well, but like I said, and nothing really ever did it for me like alcohol did. Alcohol was the one thing that just like slowed my thoughts down to where like life was like bearable, you know? Like my head was always racing when I was sober. I was constantly thinking about, worrying about what other people thought of me, you know, constantly thinking just in fear of the future, always projecting. And man, once I got drunk, like it just slowed that chatter down. And so I loved it. My dad quickly found out what he was getting himself into, and he, after I graduated high school, he sent me back down here. The next few years are me just like getting kicked out of the house, you know, couch surfing, getting arrested for like, I got arrested in a blackout. I remember waking up, I don't know if they still do this, but I remember waking up in the drunk tank at Orient Road Jail and not really sure why I was there. And my arm was like hurting bad because those Ybor City police don't play around. And I remember getting out of jail thinking, I gotta stop smoking weed. And weed had nothing to do with that arrest. Let me make that a point, that weed had nothing to do with that arrest. It was totally alcohol related. But I gotta stop smoking weed, and I need to sue those cops because they were way too rough. And this was like real, like this wasn't like I believed this stuff. Like it was the cops' fault, and I gotta stop smoking weed. Nowhere in there was it like, am I gonna quit drinking? So eventually things got bad enough to where I was hurting pretty bad. I had a cocaine habit, a daily cocaine habit, and so I was doing that all day, and I would drink booze to get to sleep. So like that was the pattern of my day. Coke all day, and then I obviously couldn't go to sleep unless I drank liquor. So I was doing that for a while, man, like life was getting unbearable. Like I couldn't even, like a minute sober was unbearable at this point. Like sobriety sucked, but the way I was living sucked too. Like it was just like, it was getting bad. I just found myself hanging with people that like, I just wasn't raised to be, you know, hanging around with people like that. When I drink, man, I end up like, for some reason, I'll end up at like a crack motel, you know, like, and I don't even smoke crack, but I end up in places like that when I'm drinking. Like it's like, so I'm doing things that like, I don't want to be this person, but I'm doing it, you know, because like alcohol and alcoholism is running my life and I have no control over it. So eventually I made it to a meeting. My uncle invited me to a meeting. He got sober in the late 80s and I reached out to him for help. He invited me to a meeting at Club 3333 and I went there, and long story short, I bounced in and out of AA for the next year and a half. But in that year and a half, I did start coming to YPG, and I met some of the guys here in YPG. And man, they would do anything for me at that time. Even though I like couldn't really string a month or two together, you know, like I would come back and they would be like, "How can we help you?" Like just here, ready, waiting for me. You know, I would always half-ass this thing during that year and a half period. I would get to that fourth and fifth step, and I would just keep a few things to myself, you know? Like, there were a few things that, like, my ego was still just too big to talk about. And I would end up drinking shortly afterward. So, eventually, I had nowhere to go. Everything I owned was in the back seat of my car, and by the grace of God, I made it back to AA, and my friends, some of them are in here, let me stay on their couch while I waited for a bed to open up in a treatment center. And I never would I have thought that was going to be my last white chip. Never would have thought it. I got so used to picking up white chips that, you know, that it's just another white chip, you know. But that was my last white chip on February 6, 2007. And I got into that treatment center. I started working the steps with my sponsor. And he told me to just do some simple things every day. Call him every day. Hit my knees in the morning. Ask God to help me stay sober for that day. And then he said, if you were successful, hit your knees and thank God for another day sober at the end of the day. Go to a meeting every day. And I was working at the time, so like, He said, if you have the day off, you can hit up two or three meetings. You know, like, he's like, you need as much AA as you can get. Because he saw me struggle. He knew the type of alcoholic I was. And I remember at one point him saying, he said, Blair's the most self-centered person I ever met. I remember him saying that. And I wore that with a badge of honor, you know. I was like, yeah, I'm sicker than you guys. But he knew I had this thing for real, man. So, like, he knew I needed to be plugged into AA. Like, I needed to be in the middle. Otherwise, I just didn't really have a chance. So, calling him every day, calling other alcoholics every day, making this my home group, getting a service commitment at this home group. Obviously, starting the steps. I started the steps with him. He took me through the steps, through the big book. So we went through the big book together, and from the beginning. And every time we would hit a step, we would work that step. And I felt like we weren't moving at a fast enough pace. And I remember telling him that I was like, dude, like I was like, can I start writing my fourth step? And I brought it up a couple times, and then finally, I think he yelled at me. He was like, he's like, if you want to find a sponsor who's going to do the steps your way, then go find that sponsor. And I was like, all right, we'll do it your way. So, like, I was just, like, looking for, like, I wanted immediate relief, you know? So I was like, we need to speed through the steps so I can start feeling better. And he was watching me, you know? He just wanted to make sure I had 1, 2, and 3 down. And because I had tried the steps so many different ways. I tried blowing through them. I tried going slow. And he was watching me. He was like, he wanted to make sure that, like, I was, that 1, 2, and 3 were solid before I moved on to 4. And once he gave me the green light to start writing my 4th step, I started writing my 4th step. And I remember it was at the treatment center Axe in Drew Park, right where Amethyst is, the long-term treatment center behind it. I remember going in that cafeteria, and every night for about 30 minutes I would write, because I just knew that if I didn't put 30 minutes in every night, that I might procrastinate. It might take longer than it should. And I just wanted to, like, I did not want to drink. I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to give my alcoholism a chance to, like, take me out, you know? And so I remember sitting in that cafeteria writing my 4th step, and I got to those things that I would always hold back on. And I'm like, man, like, and I got to that part in the into action in the beginning of that chapter where it talks about why we like the good reasons why we should do the 5th step. And it said, let's the best reason first. If we don't do this, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. And I remember reading that, and I was like, I'm either going to do it or I'm going to drink. Like, there's no, like, it's A or B. There's no C anymore. Like, for some reason, I always thought there was a C option before, which was like, C, my way. And this time, I just became convinced that it's A or B. I'm going to do this the way it's outlined in the big book, or I'm going to drink. So I remember I just wrote the stuff out. I wrote it. I shared it with him, and I was scared, man. But, dude, like, after I shared that with him, some of those things he had done, I was like, holy crap. Like, I was afraid to talk about that, and he's done it. And then I remember, like, a couple weeks later, hearing a lady in a meeting share about doing one of those things as well in a meeting. Like, I don't even remember what it was, but I remember thinking, like, man, that thing was going to kill me. That one, like, if I didn't talk about it, that would have killed me. And here this lady is talking about it in front of a group of people in a meeting. I was like, dude, like, I was like, thank God I did that. So moving on with the steps, obviously I did 6 and 7 after that. I did my hour, and 6 and 7 have been ongoing for me. That's not something that I've done once. When I'm in enough pain, I'll become willing to ask God to remove a character defect, you know. But a lot of times in my experience, if I feel like it's still benefiting me and it's not causing enough pain yet, like, I'll use that character defect, and it'll cause me problems. It'll create problems, you know. Like, a good example of that early on in sobriety, I remember I was living in my treatment center, and man, like, talk about social anxiety. Like, I hated being around people. Like, I would wake up in the morning with just like this, like, just overwhelming fear of going into work because I was gonna have to see people and talk to people. So sometimes I just wouldn't show up for work. Like, that's how bad this fear was. I'd end up doing AA all day. I would, like, go to a jail meeting, or, like, go, like, end up doing 3 or 4 meetings, and, like, the whole time worrying about whether I was going to have a job tomorrow or not. The reason I bring that up is because, like, that was my solution to the fear, right? Like, don't show up to work. But it creates more problems. Like, it created more problems. Here I am worrying all day whether or not I'm going to have a job. So, like, eventually, God removed that from me when I became willing. Like, I remember I got fired, and I remember getting to another job, and it was happening again, and my boss sitting me down and saying, I've had this talk before from bosses, but she sat me down and she said, if you show up late one more time, you're losing your job. Something happened to where, like, I became willing to have God remove that at that point. I prayed about it hard, and it hasn't been a struggle since. Like, I don't struggle with showing up to work. So that's just one example of just, like, a character defect, like, holding on to it until the pain becomes great enough. And then moving on to, so I stayed in that treatment center for about 6 months. I moved out. I've lived with people in AA for, like, my first 6 years of sobriety, 6 or 7 years of sobriety. I always had a roommate in AA, which was a blessing, to have somebody in AA, somebody close in AA to live with. Eventually, I'll talk about 8 and 9. I did make amends. I had to go back to previous employers, employers that I had stolen from, and admit my wrongs and do whatever it took to make it right. And I had to go back to family for harms that I had caused with family. And there was a lot of fear going into that, especially like with the family, but also with employers. Like, I was like, I might be able to get arrested doing this. You know, I'm admitting to stealing stuff, and I would pray before I would go in and make the amends, and the cops never showed up. So it was it always ended up working out. Like, most of the time with those type of amends, the person on the other side was happy to see where I was at. They were happy that I was sober. They knew how I was before. So for them to see where I was at that point, they were happy for me. And as I did that, I started to clear up the wreckage of my past. I started to get a little lighter, you know, like that wall that I had between me and people, like I shared about before. Like, I always felt like there was a wall between me and people. It started to get knocked down. And, like, those resentments that I walked around with for years, that one in particular toward my dad, that started to go away. And that went away, that I remember that going away after I made amends to him. Because, man, when I lived up there with him in New Jersey, I caused a lot of havoc. Like, I caused problems for him, getting brought home by the cops, like his friends, people that knew him. Like, he's been a cop for 30 years. People that knew him were taking me home because I was out in the public in a blackout, bringing drugs into the house, like, you name it. So I got to make amends for that, you know, and he forgave me. And then I forgave him. And that happened with a lot of those resentments. And then 10, 11, and 12, I started, I was taking inventory, going over it with my sponsor. That's how I stay current with my sponsor. And prayer and meditation, I mean, I was doing that already. Like, I was doing that, you know, up until this point. So prayer and meditation. And then I started sponsoring guys. And that's where my like sobriety and my relationship with God really started to deepen, was sponsoring guys. And every time I would take a guy through the steps, even if it was just the first three steps, because a lot of guys that I sponsored would do 1, 2, and 3 and then disappear. But every time I would take a guy through the steps, I would be going back through it, and I would be looking at those steps like from the perspective of where I'm at now. So like at 5 years, there would be things popping up, taking a guy through the steps that didn't pop up when I did my steps, you know, in my early sobriety. So it deepens it. And I got to go back to school. Like, there was a huge fear that I wanted to be a firefighter, paramedic, but man, I knew I had a felony record, and I knew that I didn't think I had a chance, you know? I was just like, I'm going to be wasting my time going through the motions with that, because this is what my head was telling me, because I got a record, nobody's going to hire me, when I get to that lie detector test, like, I there's some stuff that I'm not going to want to talk about, but what AA taught me was to just suit up and leave the results in God's hands. And I had been practicing that for years at this point. I had been practicing that in AA. So it was time to practice that in this situation, right? So I did that. I showed up to school, even though I was like, I don't know if I'm going to get a job or not. But I just showed up to school, and I prayed through it. I was sponsored through it. And long story short, I ended up getting hired shortly after I finished school, and I've been working with the fire department for almost 8 years now, and sometimes it's just crazy to think like that I'm in charge of the narcotics that are in the safe at work. I'm like, I got the keys to the safe. Like, are you? But like to think about my past and compare it, it's like kind of crazy. But to know where I'm at now, it's not really crazy. Like, it's not really a scary thing anymore. But so that happened. Like I said, this was my home group. I used to take a meeting into Amethyst on Tuesdays, and I remember here they would ask. They would say some of our home group members take meetings in the detoxes and jails. If you're one of those members, raise your hand. And I would raise my hand, and then they would say, if you're interested in taking a meeting in with some of these people, get with them after the meeting. So my wife now, she got with me after the meeting, acting like she was interested in taking a meeting into detox with me. She's like, oh yeah, Tuesday, okay, yeah, 7, I could do that. And we started, that's when we exchanged phone numbers. And she still hasn't come to detox with me to this day. To this day, she has not come to detox. And but we started dating, and then we got married. And man, 15 years, like, I just, it's flown by. A lot has happened. There's been a lot of challenges, a lot of ups and downs. The ups and downs aren't quite as extreme. Life shows up. I continue to be sponsored. I continue to sponsor guys. I continue to be active in AA. I don't like speaking, but when I'm asked of anything in AA, I say yes. I was taught that right from the beginning. Never say no to AA. Unless I had some sort of prior engagement, or, you know, then I then I better say yes to AA, man. For what AA has given me, I could never fully repay it. I find that I get the most benefit out of like the more uncomfortable things, right, or the more inconvenient things. So anyway, I'm grateful for my sobriety. I'm grateful for you guys, and I guess that's it.
All right. Let's give another hand for the speakers one more time, guys. Thank you. Thank you, Blair. All right, at this time, we're going to be passing out the basket in accordance with our seventh tradition. If you would like to contribute electronically, please see our treasurer who's standing up, hand up. And we're also going to pass out the chips here while we do that. Josh, alcoholic. We have a chip system. And first chip we offer is a